This is The Book Show, and tonight's extended show is of 1 hour, so we'll be talking to lots of writers. You can also follow us on Twitter, we're at BookshowRTE. Later on, we'll be hearing about the troubled life of the writer Jean Rhys and discussing her work with Colm O'Shea and Linda Grant. But first, as the Quirch International Festival of Literature kicks off in Galway this week, we'll be speaking to many writers who'll be taking part. One writer who'll be there is John Boyne, whose latest novel, The Heart's Invisible Furies, begins in 1945 in Cork, where a pregnant 16-year-old girl is summoned to the altar by a priest. The novel moves through the decades, ending in 2015 as Ireland has voted for marriage equality. That child turns out to be Cyril Avery, who was given up for adoption, and the novel tells the story of his life as a gay man growing up in post-war Ireland. John Boyne is here with me in studio now to discuss The Heart's Invisible Furies. And John, your last novel, A History of Loneliness, tackled the sex abuse scandals in the church, and this novel has a different kind of anger, but with an optimistic vision. So how influential was that marriage equality referendum in writing this book?
I started writing the book really because of the marriage referendum. I started writing it about a year and a half before that took place. I was aware, as most people were, that this referendum was coming, and I was slightly nervous of it because I knew that it would mean that there would be a lot of naysayers on the radio, on television, in the papers, and I didn't really like the idea of it. I thought it was going to be quite a negative time. But at the same time, I thought, how did Ireland get from being a country that only 25 years ago had decriminalised homosexuality to being a country which was potentially going to be the first in the world to vote by public plebiscite for equal rights marriage? So that's where it started from, the really kind of the questioning about how Ireland had changed in really such a short space of time.
Early in the novel, we're introduced to the very dashing figure of Julian Woodbead, and naturally Cyril develops a crush on his best friend. He's sexually precocious, he's highly daring, he's intelligent. So how does this friendship develop, and how important is it in Cyril's life?
It's certainly the most important relationship in Cyril's life for the first 35 years of his life, the first half of the book. Julian is everything that Cyril isn't, in a way. He's confident, he's full of life, full of energy, he's crazy about girls. He's everything that Cyril really would like to be. And at the start, before Cyril even realises what sexuality is, he's drawn to this boy. He's drawn to him at only the age of 7, when they're both 7. And he just wants to be his best friend. He wants to be around him all the time. And as they get older, as they hit their teens, their early 20s, that relationship changes because Cyril has basically fallen in love with him and doesn't know how to express those feelings. He's terrified of them for his own life. He's terrified of what society would say, but he's also frightened of what Julian would say, whether he would end his friendship with him. But Julian is not a bad character. He lives his life exactly the way he wants to live it. He loves women. He sleeps with as many women as he possibly can. They seem to enjoy it. So I think Cyril is at times jealous of him as well as being in love with him.
Cyril's mother had to give her baby up for adoption in the 1940s, and Cyril is taken in by the Averys, who remind him all the way through the novel that he's not really one of them. Is there a deliberate commentary on Mother Ireland maybe rejecting her gay sons and daughters?
Well, in the first instance, I mean, the deliberate comment really was on how Catherine Goggin would be treated as a teenage girl pregnant in the 1940s, how she would be banished from her parish, not just by the parish priest, but by her own family, who would never speak to her again, and how she would have to go to Dublin and start a new life as a teenager. But I didn't want to make her a victim at all. You know, I wanted her to be quite strong in that. And in terms of Cyril's relationship with his adoptive parents, it's not that they are that they have any issue with his homosexuality. We actually don't really see very much of that with his parents. It's more that they're sort of just an eccentric couple that they keep telling him he's not a real Avery. But as strange as it sounds, I'm not saying it out of meanness. It's more just a fact. He's really the only adult in that house. And these parents, Charles and Maud, are almost kind of comic relief in the novel. I'd never written that kind of comedy before, and I wanted to. And I thought the repetition of telling him that he's not a real Avery, but doing it in a way where he wasn't being insulted by it, would hopefully work.
Let's take a short reading from the beginning of the novel, where the priest, Father Monroe, has denounced Catherine Goggin from the altar and the congregation are reeling in shock. The book is narrated by Cyril.
The congregation gasped in horrified delight at his words, the teenage boys thrilled by such notions. And as she picked herself up off the ground, the priest stepped forward again and dragged her by the arm through the nave of the church, spittle dribbling down his mouth and chin, his face red with indignation. And perhaps his excitement was even visible to those who knew where to look for it. My grandmother looked around, but my grandfather gave her a puck on the arm, and she turned back. My Uncle Eddie, the youngest of the six and the closest in age to my mother, stood up and shouted, "Ah, come on, that's enough now." And at those words, my grandfather stood too and laid his son out with one punch to the jaw.
And that was John Boyne reading from The Heart's Invisible Furies. John, the book is actually peppered with many moments of that kind of profound violence, such as the episode you've just read. And it begins with the priest kicking a pregnant woman, and there are many punches and attacks throughout Cyril's life and some horrific hate crimes. Is Ireland a less violent country now, or is there still a sense of fear for women and for gay people?
I think there would still be a certain anxiety, yeah. I think it's definitely not what it once was. But I would still be sort of slightly nervous of, you know, holding hands with a guy on the street or kissing somebody on the street or in a bar the way that any guy and girl would. I don't think you're going to get necessarily attacked, but I do think people are going to look over at you. I mean, if I'm honest, you know, if I saw two guys kissing or two girls kissing in a bar, I'd probably do a double take as well, just because you don't see it every day. But I think it's more sort of if you were walking home on a dark night, you'd still be slightly conscious of that.
I think so. Cyril also has to unlearn so much of his identity towards the end of the novel as Ireland becomes less homophobic. This is the first time you've tackled this subject in your writing. As a gay man yourself, though younger than Cyril, did you feel the same way about learning to accept yourself?
Yeah, I did. But I came out a lot younger than Cyril. I was confident enough in my early 20s to tell my parents that, to tell my friends that. But that didn't make it any easier for me. I still found it quite hard to form relationships, really. I was okay at being honest with people, but this was, what, the early 90s. It still wasn't very easy to meet people, to find people, and to be able to form those kind of relationships. Cyril takes a lot longer, but it is at a different time. And also, he's only able to really do it when he leaves Ireland. When we finally see Cyril in a place of acceptance, he's already in Amsterdam in 1980, which is exactly halfway through the book, and he's 35 by then. That's when he first is able to. I kind of needed to get him out of the country for 14 years in Amsterdam and New York for him to be able to really be honest with himself and the world. I wasn't so bad on that, but I think if I was 20 now, it would be a lot easier. It'd be a lot more fun.
No doubt. The book is also full of, interestingly, real life characters, people we'll actually know. Eamon de Valera, you know, is complaining about his bunions, and Cyril is kind of desperate to avoid Dan at his own wedding. There's a lot of satire, there's lots of scenes of comedy, and this, as you say, is a bit of a departure for you in your writing. Was it difficult to do that, to get the balance right of dealing with, you know, heavy topics, but then make things comic at times too?
The strange thing is, as I was writing it, it seemed to flow along very well, and books don't always flow quite as well, I find. Sometimes they're harder to write. This one, because I was maybe employing a part of my brain that I never had before, the comic element, the jokes just, once I allowed them into the narrative, they seemed to flow. That was really quite good fun. And people like De Valera, Charlie Haughey's in it, and Brendan Behan is in it. You know, they just show up for little cameo moments, but it's quite good fun putting words into their mouth. And that's something that I've been doing really since my first novel, The Thief of Time, in 2000. I've often brought real life figures into the stories that I've been writing. But balancing the comedy and the tragedy, I think it just comes with complete focus on the novel as you're writing it, that instinctively you know how to shape the book so that it works alongside each other.
Mm. Very recently we've heard the horrifying story about Tuam and mother and baby homes, and this book feels very timely in the context of that. Had you looked at any of those cases, any of those histories?
Not specifically when I was writing it, no. It was more, there was a case when I was a boy in school, when I was about 15 or 16, and there was a girl, I remember, also a teenager, who I think had given birth in a park in Dublin and died. And I remember it being a real scandal at the time and quite scary for a teenager to listen to, quite horrific. And you hear stories like that often. You hear things like the Magdalene laundries and so on, and the way women were treated and girls were treated. And I think this book is quite a feminist book to a large extent. I think a lot of my work is. I think there is a connection between gay people and feminism in the sense of minorities battling against the status quo. Most of the women in this book are really strong, forthright women, and most of the men are, you know, blundering idiots half the time, and it's kind of deliberately so.
Thanks so much, John. And John Boyne's The Heart's Invisible Furies is published by Doubleday. John will also be reading at the Cúirt Festival of Literature in Galway this Thursday night, April 27th, and all details of that can be found at cúirt.ie. Yorkshire poet and playwright Simon Armitage will also be in Galway next week, and his new collection of poetry, The Unaccompanied, has just been published. The poems reflect how globalisation and economic recession have increasingly divided British society. Mythical characters like Odysseus share the pages with NHS workers, and many of the poems are set in the old mining valleys of the poet's childhood. Simon Armitage spoke to the book show about his work and began by reading the title poem, The Unaccompanied.
The Unaccompanied. Wandering slowly back after dark one night above a river towards a suspension bridge, a sound concerns him that might be a tune or might not. Noise drifting in, trailing off. Then concerns him again, now clearly a song pulsing out from the opposite bank, being sung by chorusing men, all pewter-haired or bald, in the function suite of a shabby hotel. Above their heads, a conductor's hand draws and casts the notes with a white wand. Songs about mills and mines and a great war, about mermaid brides and solid gold hills, songs from broken hymn books and cheesy films. Then his father's voice rising out of that choir, and his father's father's voice, and voices of fathers before, concerning him only, arcing through charged air and spanning the gorge. He steps over the cliff edge and walks across. The poem's actually set probably somewhere like Bristol and the Avon Gorge there, and was written at a time of some sort of personal dislocation. I think it merges and melds with ideas of home. I grew up and still live in the valleys of West Yorkshire, and these are valleys that run out of the towns up into the Pennines. Ted Hughes was born and grew up in the next valley system just up to the north. So some of them are quite sort of deeply incised valleys, dark little corridors, and others are wider and more expansive, but they all lead up onto this moorland, the Pennine Hills up on the top, which I always thought of as a great sort of empty canvas available for writing. I suppose in some ways, you know, that makes it a poem, you know, thoughts turn into home poem, but also I think included in it is an element of magic realism there at the end. It's impossible to go back into that past. I think, as is often the case, I didn't really know what I was up to with this book until about two-thirds of the way through, and I had a little stock take at that point, and I printed all the poems off and leafed through them and spread them out on the living room carpet. And what I recognised there was the way that I'd been documenting and describing the sociology of Britain, really, from about the time of the economic crash, so since about 2008, particularly the northern landscape and environment, post-industrial, well, sort of post-post-industrial Yorkshire, I suppose you might say, and the north of England, and all the alienation and marginalisation and the small personal diminishments as well that followed on from that. So this theme of solitariness and being unaccompanied is a sort of a loneliness from community, I think, and the same for the communities as well. I mean, thinking about the village that I grew up in, where I go back to a lot, and it's not so much that it's falling behind or that it is the deserted village in any way. In some ways, it's relatively prosperous. It's just becoming a very, you know, homogenized place. Everything is starting to look like everything else. So you used to have all these little bumps and bends in the village, and individual buildings and services that were very bespoke to that community. And now, you know, you drive through and it pretty much looks like everywhere else. And I think that drives people to a different form of loneliness and probably sends them back behind their computer screens and their double glazing. And what gets lost there is communication and dialogue and human contact. I'm making this sound like an incredibly miserable book. I should say there's some sort of light touches and dark humour in and amongst. But yeah, it was something that I recognised in the later stages of the writing, really, rather than it being a project from the word go. This is the poem Camera Obscura. This 8-year-old sitting in Bramall's field, shoes scuffed from kicking a stone, too young for a key but old enough now to walk the short mile back from school. He spied his mother down in the village, crossing the street, purse in her fist. In her other hand, her shopping bag nurses, 4 ugly potatoes caked in mud, a boiling of peas, rags of meat or a tail of fish in greaseproof paper, the price tottered up in pencilled columns of shillings and pence. How warm must she be in that winter coat? On Old Mount Road, the nearer she gets, the smaller she shrinks, till he reaches out to carry her home on the flat of his hand or his fingertip, and she doesn't exist.
Thanks to Simon Armitage for joining us on The Book Show. The Unaccompanied is published by Faber, and Simon will be at Kirch with American poet Terence Hayes next Saturday night, April 29th at 8:30 p.m. Now, 90 years ago, a collection of stories called The Left Bank was published. It told stories of young women, mostly in Paris, and their relationships with often undesirable men. Alcohol, poverty and alienation were also themes explored in the collection. The author of these modern and often brutal stories was a Dominican-born woman called Ella Gwendolyn Rees Williams, but she became better known as Jean Rees. Later, I'll be speaking to author Linda Grant, who's a champion of Rees's work, but first, writer Colm O'Shea paints a picture of the types of settings her characters found themselves in.
Jean Rees's early novels are all predominantly set in London and Paris and other parts of Europe. She did see the high life, the cafes, the restaurants, but also the behind-the-scenes life of the dance halls, the pubs, the lonely boarding houses, the gritty bars where she would spend her time struggling to survive. She worked as a dancer, she was a model, she was also the mistress to older men. She might often struggle to raise rent of a boarding house or skip out on the rent to move somewhere else. She did what she had to do to survive. She lived a life of loneliness, and many times there was certainly abandonment, I think, is something that's always in her work. She wasn't one for the drawing rooms or the stately homes, but I suppose she saw enough of the litter not only to enjoy it occasionally, but also to resent it when it went and to be able to see through it.
And we'll be hearing more from Colm O'Shea. But now, novelist Linda Grant joins me from London. Linda, I've already called you a champion of Rees's work, but you went further in an article and you wrote and said that you'd die to write like her. That's a pretty bold statement.
Well, it might have been a figure of speech, but she is the writer whose style I'm most jealous of because I can't work out how it's done. I just don't know how she does it. And I look back at these, you know, very unadorned sentences, and somehow she's managed to bring this to a sort of point of, you know, shock, of heartbreak, without any of what writers you call colour.
Rees was born on Dominica Island in 1890. Her father was a Welsh doctor and her mother was Dominican Creole, or mixed race. Rees was sent to a school in England at 16, but this didn't work out so well for her and she was mocked as an outsider. Linda, how does England appear in her novels and stories?
Cold, very, very cold and very hostile towards her. She really inhabits the skin of a woman from the Caribbean. she senses the racism, she senses the poverty, the lack of colour. Everything to her is denuded, it's bleak, and she hates it. She absolutely hates it.
One of her short stories, Let Them Call It Jazz, echoes her own life. It's about a young woman, Selena Davis, from Martinique, who arrives in England and lives in squalor, relying on the help of untrustworthy men. Let's hear a short reading from that story, read here by the actress Donna Anita Nicolaisen.
One bright Sunday morning in July, I have trouble with my Notting Hill landlord because he asked for a month's rent in advance. He tell me this after I lived there since winter, settling up every week without fail. I have no job at the time, and if I give the money he want, there's not much left. So I refuse. The man drunk already at that early hour, and he abused me. All talk. He can't frighten me. But his wife is a bad one. She walk in my room and say she must have cash. When I tell her no, she give my suitcase one kick and it burst open. My best dress fall out. Then she laugh and give another kick. She say month in advance as usual, and if I can't pay, find somewhere else. Don't talk to me about London. Plenty people there have heart like stone.
The character Selena Davis in that story, Let Them Call It Jazz, can't cope with her new surroundings. This gives way to drinking and manic outbursts and even a stint in Holloway Prison. Now, we know that Rhys went through similar episodes, including a spell in prison. So does her writing on depression and mania feel like it's drawn from experience?
Well, she has said that she doesn't have an imagination, that she can't create character, that she can't create plot. So I think we can take it as read that she's writing from her own very, very deep experience, not necessarily things, incidents which have happened to her. I actually saw a stage play of, let them call it Jazz, at the Donmar Warehouse a couple of decades ago, which was a really remarkable production. And you felt that, you know, almost like a sort of Sylvia Plath bell jar of English life descending on her. So I think it's very much from the heart and from the spirit. She's not really writing about anybody else.
Linda, so many of her books and stories are set in Paris. So how did the city open her up and change her?
The Paris novels are really kind of pretty remarkable because they were discovered, rediscovered by feminists, I think, in the 1970s. And because she is not a wife, because she's not really a wife in these stories, and she's certainly not a mother, even though she was a mother, what they're about is aging, loneliness, the absolutely brutal truth of being dependent on no good men, but told with a lack of any kind of sentimentality, a sort of an extraordinary savagery, which creates this voice which is just so totally compelling.
In the 1930s, Jean Rhys published some of her most famous novels, but even with some success, she all but disappeared. By the 1960s, she'd been divorced, was twice widowed, and lived a boozy life of seclusion in Devon. But then, in 1966, comes Wide Sargasso Sea. It's a short novel which Rhys wrote as a prequel to Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. In Bronte's novel, spoiler alert, Jane is set to marry Mr. Rochester when she discovers a woman, Rochester's wife in fact, Bertha, lives in his attic. In Rhys's novel, we hear from Bertha herself, a woman like Rhys, who arrived to England from Dominica. Writer Colm O'Shea reflects on Wide Sargasso Sea.
When Wide Sargasso Sea was published in 1966, Jean Rhys's books had been long out of print. She was almost forgotten, and many who did remember her probably thought she was dead. But Wide Sargasso Sea appears with this heady mix of heat and sex and eroticism, a world of magic and potions for the husband who arrives from England. This is a very, very alien culture, alien people, alien concepts and practices. Yet it's one where that Antoinette, the protagonist, revels in because it's where she's lived and grown up all her life.
Our garden was large and beautiful as that garden in the Bible, but it had gone wild. The paths were overgrown, and a smell of dead flowers mixed with the fresh living smell. Underneath the tree ferns, the light was green. Orchids flourished out of reach, or for some reason not to be touched. One was snaky looking, another like an octopus with long, thin, brown tentacles bare of leaves hanging from a twisted root. Twice a year, the octopus orchid flowered. It was a bell-shaped mass of white, mauve, deep purples, wonderful to see. The scent was very sweet and strong. I never went near it.
White Sargasso Sea opens in Jamaica with the life of Antoinette Cosway, the daughter of a plantation owner. A fire kills her brother and drives her mother mad, and Antoinette is sent to a convent. Years later, Antoinette is visited by a suitor, a young gentleman from England, whose name we never hear. They marry, but after an initial honeymoon period, he starts to receive poison pen letters, questioning both Antoinette's mother's sanity and her own. This drives a wedge between them, and he becomes colder and colder towards her. She struggles to cope and indeed start to exhibit signs of insanity herself, almost semi-catatonic, a zombie in a sense.
She was very pale and shaking all over, so I gave her the smelling salts on the dressing table. She put the bottle to her nose, and her hand dropped as though she were too tired to hold it steady. Then she turned away from the window. The sky, the looking glass, the pretty things on the dressing table. She turned her face to the wall. "The Lord has forsaken us," she said, and shut her eyes.
She is then taken with her husband back to England, where we then see her living in the attic of Thornfield Hall, where she is cared for by a maid called Grace Poole. She is mad at this stage. She occasionally wanders the halls. She has a recurring dream where she is released by setting fire to the house and leaping from the ramparts. And as the novel closes, she awakens to bring that dream to life. The novel being set in Jamaica, and I suppose her own upbringing in Dominica would, I'm guessing, have been quite similar, but certainly it was an environment she knew and understood quite well. And it's very noticeable that her husband really dislikes it and wants to go back to England. For Reese, I suppose the opposite was true. She had lived in Dominica until she was 16 and she was sent to England to school. And then because of her own upbringing and even her accent, she was made to feel very much as an outsider. And it was interesting that initially the novel can be seen as giving voice to a character who never had a voice. But I feel she was also trying to reclaim her own voice and doing it through the language and the environment in which she had grown up. In a sense, she was turning her back on her European life at that stage, maybe in a way that Antoinette did as well. While it is, on the face of it, about a minor character in a much-loved novel of the English canon, I feel that she and Bertha and Antoinette were inhabiting the one character at the time.
And thanks there to Colm O'Shea. Still with me is writer Linda Grant. Linda, Jane Eyre is a much-loved classic, so does White Sargasso Sea do it justice as a prequel?
Well, I shocked an audience at the British Library by saying I thought it was a better novel. I'm not a great fan of Jane Eyre, and I always feel that sort of by the end, she's saddled with Rochester, and I'm not sure about that marriage. It was published when I was at school, and the school library bought a copy. And of course, I'd never heard of Jean Rhys, and I read this, and I had read Jane Eyre, and it was absolutely sensational to me. I thought it was an extraordinary novel, and I read it probably two or three times since then. It was probably the first of what people called the novel about colonial life and about what happens when people come from the Caribbean to England. But it's also a novel about rape, about mental illness. It's a horrifying book. And in Jane Eyre, Bertha is almost animal-like. Charlotte Bronte does not really give her any human characteristics at all. But the character of Bertha in White Sargasso Sea is a really fully formed human being who is capricious and vain and selfish. And what happens to her is absolutely shocking.
Because of White Sargasso Sea, Rhys enjoyed literary fame and went on to write more mature and successful work that reflected where she was in her own life. Old age, loneliness, and sexual desire are often themes she explores. Let's hear from one of her later stories on not shooting sitting birds.
It was a most uncomfortable dinner. We both avoided looking at the bedroom, and when the last mouthful was swallowed, he announced that he was going to take me home. The way he said this rather puzzled me. Then I told myself that probably he was curious to see where I lived. Neither of us spoke in the taxi except to say, "Well, good night. Good night." I felt regret when it came to taking off my lovely pink chemise, but I could still think. Some other night, perhaps. Another sort of man. I slept at once.
Linda, Jean Rees left an unfinished autobiography, Smile Please, and her life story has been staged and televised. And there's no doubt that she had a life of appalling hardship, yet she wrote her way through it. She's always had devoted fans, but do you think she's something to offer a modern audience today, an audience maybe who weren't grappling with the kind of morality she was?
Well, I mean, I wasn't grappling with that morality when I was reading her in the 1970s. What I found so remarkable about her was that she's the voice of longing, of being screwed up, of wanting what you can't have. One of the really odd things about her novels is she struck me as being what would happen to the characters in a Jane Austen novel if they were suddenly upended and turned into the early 20th century. Because what those characters never do is say, "Oh, I'll get a job." I mean, she is not struggling. They're not struggling for independence at all. That's what's so terrifying about them. They're struggling to be loved, to be adored, to be cosseted like a pet. But at the same time, those women can't stand it when that happens because they are too selfish. And so their lives are impossible. And that's what she deals with, the impossibility of our own human nature, our own paradoxes. That's why she's so remarkable. She doesn't strike me as being any kind of feminist role model, very, very far from it. Yet her work is so, it's so painful, it's so acute, and it's so truthful. It's the truthfulness of that voice which makes her so remarkable.
Well, thanks to Linda Grant for joining us here on The Book Show, and thanks too to our reader this evening, the actress Donna Anita Nicolaisen. Jean Rees's novels are all published by Penguin, and they've just published her collected short stories, and we'll listen to one last short reading from her story, The Bluebird.
The scent that came from the dress was very faint at first, and then it grew stronger. The smell of vetiver and frangipani, of cinnamon and dust and lime trees when they're flowering. The smell of the sun and the smell of the rain.
Galway-based writer Alan McMonagall will be discussing his debut novel, Ithaca, at Coorch later this week. It's also longlisted for the Desmond Elliott Prize. It's set in a small, unnamed town in Ireland in 2009, after the economic crash, and it tells the story of 11-year-old Jason Lowry and his mother, or Ma, Jacinta. They live in dire poverty, and Jacinta, an alcoholic, begins a relationship with the landlord of their rundown house. A mysterious girl appears and develops a friendship with Jason as Ma's life begins to unravel. Alan McMonagall joins me now to discuss Ithaca. And I guess, Alan, a good place to start is probably with the town itself, which you describe in a lot of detail. And there is that sense of it as, you know, a ghost town. It's derelict. It's half falling down. And this is just after the economic crash. So why did you set the story at that time?
I was probably travelling across the country at the time quite a lot myself. I was giving some writing classes in the town I grew up in. What occurred to me was just the changes post these so-called boom years. And it kind of broke my heart, you know, seeing all these bricked up dwellings and business premises and, you know, the ghost estates. They seem to be everywhere. And, the closer into the Midlands that I got, the more prevalent it became. And it really sort of made an impression.
In terms of that town, let's get a sense of it maybe with the reading from the book. This is a section where Jason is walking through the streets. Let's hear a section from Ithaca.
Pulled my hoodie tight, kept my eyes on the path in front of me, made my way further up the street. I stopped outside Masterson's jewellery shop, stared at some watches, thought about grabbing a diamond ring in a velvet-lined box. Masterson was on to me, though, and I shuffled off again. Past a building bricked up where its windows should have been, couldn't remember what it had been before. A fashion shop, a high-class restaurant, a cocktail bar. Who knew? Past Dante's Chipper, Dunn's Stores Better Value beats them all. Pause at where I was sure Myrta's newsagents used to be. Was greeted by a sheet of paper taped to the blacked-out window and a scrawl of handwriting that said, "Shop closed until further notice."
And that was Alan McMonagle reading there from Ithaca. Jason's only 11, but he's had to grow up super fast. He's neglected and he vents his anger. He's also self-harming. But he's desperate to know who his father is. And despite all that darkness, he's still sort of full of love and full of wonder. How did you come up with this character and the kind of personality that you wanted him to have? How did you decide that?
Well, I suppose the voice came first. You know, as you point out, Sinead, it's a young voice. When we meet him, he's 11, nearly 12. And of course, because of, I suppose, the overall conditions of his life when we first meet him, the so-called collapse of the Celtic Tiger and so forth, there's a lot of confusion and uncertainty. But when we meet Jason, really, I think what's bugging him are the conditions are they're a lot closer to home. His personal life, if you like. Primarily, when we meet him, he's at loggerheads with the woman that he's living with. That is his vodka-swilling, joy-riding, boyfriend-entertaining, swings-from-the-hip ma, and fed up with her antics. Yeah, he gets it inside his head that he's going to go on a search for his old man, his da. And so it essentially becomes a quest story.
The other central female character in the book is a girl whose name we actually never get to know. He meets this mysterious girl at the Swamp, which is a wasteland on the outside of town. And what she does is she talks to him about stories from the past, about myth, about Greek heroes and ancient Egypt, the Russian steppes and Ithaca itself, which is the title of your book. So tell me a little bit more about this place, Ithaca, and the role that these stories play in the lives of Jason and this girl.
Jason quickly, he strikes up a fast friendship with this girl who, as you say, remains unnamed, just like the town itself, which is very much landlocked. And I suppose the claustrophobic horizons that follow on from this uncertain times that the Celtic Tiger and its collapse have brought on, they lead Jason and the girl, they bring Jason and the girl together. And what they do is they start to swap stories and share exotic tales of faraway places, places that contain pretty much everything that does not exist in their current stomping ground. And so they conjure old stories of ancient Egypt, Greek myths, you know, the quest for the golden fleece, the wooden horse of Troy. I mean, I try and pack as much faraway geography, if you like, as possible into the narratives that they swap with each other. And I suppose the inference being that these places, and by extension the title of the book itself, Ithaca, come to represent a place of light, a place of escape for my troubled protagonist.
What is Ithaca?
It has a very concrete meaning for Jason in the sense that it is very much a place that he has come across in the stories that he's read. But also it does represent a place that he aspires to get to one day. I think it's symbolic and very much real.
At one point in the novel, you reveal, quite surprisingly, I think, that Jacinta is only 30 years old. But he witnesses very graphic moments in her life, very adult moments, I suppose, with she has an affair with Mario, the landlord. Mm-hmm. He's trying to deal with her drinking and depression as a very young boy. And it isn't a typical mother-son relationship by any stretch. And it's clear that she isn't coping, even if and he isn't either. Your portrayal of Jacinta is still sympathetic. I mean, she's not completely monstrous or vile.
No, I'm glad you said that. I tend to agree. Early on into the book, I wasn't quite sure how I was going to deal with her, or indeed, as a writer, how I felt about her. But the further into the narrative that I progressed, you know, I came to have a grudging admiration for her. And indeed, I would almost go as far as to say she became my favourite character in the book. And the age is important as well. 29, almost 30. So to me, she's still young enough to have her own dreams and wishes and ambitions. And by extension, her own frustrations and disappointments. And so I guess what she's doing is lashing out in the only way she knows how. And to me, that makes her a very human person.
The town is grim. And apart from the main characters we've just talked about, there's a small cast of characters who almost have these very caricature-y names, you know, like Fluky, Slug Doyle, the cycling postman, Barabbas Diffley, which is a great name. But then when Jason starts to lose his grip on reality, it's clear that there is, even though everybody has their own problems, there's still a sense of community, this idea that, you know, maybe it takes a village to raise a child. So people still look out for him, even though they've all got their own issues. People give him food. He's given, when he goes to the local bar, he's given Fanta and peanuts. So he's not completely neglected.
That's right. You know, your question is very well put, and the words that you use are wisely chosen. In my writing, I'm influenced quite a lot by that American short story writer from the 60s, Flannery O'Connor. And what I loved were the almost cartoon-like universes that she would initially establish. And then she'd, you know, flip that and, completely turn the tables on the readers and indeed the characters in her stories. To a certain extent, that's what I was at here. This wide cast of supporting characters that you refer to. Initially, they are presented almost as caricatures, cartoons. But gradually, again, and as Jason's situation starts to unravel, we do see that their humanity again come to the fore as they begin to, in their own small ways, look out for Jason.
There's bleakness and there's humour in the story and characters that any reader would like to spend time with. And it's very specific in terms of your language. It's interesting that you mentioned Flannery O'Connor. And I'm wondering, when you're writing about small town Ireland and she was writing about small town America, were there Irish writers who influenced you in terms of that small town rural mindset?
Yeah, I suppose, and I've already been hearing this quite a lot. One of the writers would be Patrick McCabe. The Butcher Boy would have been a big book for me at the time. And of course, he's a past teacher of mine as well. But I think Jason Lowry is a lot different from Francie Brady, where Francie sort of lashes out at everything around him. My little guy, I mean, literally, he wouldn't harm a fly. The only person he is a danger to, ultimately, is himself. So there is a crucial difference there, I think. But certainly Patrick McCabe would have been a big influence.
Alan, thanks so much, and enjoy Quirch. Alan McMonagall's Ithaca is published by Picador, and Alan will be discussing this book at Quirch this Friday on April 28th as part of a debut panel which includes, among other people, Lisa Harding, Roisin O'Donnell and Amanda Reynolds. Now, Ross Raisin is the last of our Quirch guests this evening. His latest novel, A Natural, tells the story of Tom Pearman, a promising young professional footballer who, like his teammates, is hungry for fame, wealth and success. However, the path isn't clear for Tom as he struggles with his sexuality in a world where being gay is famously said to be the last taboo. This is Ross's third novel, following on from God's Own Country and Waterline. And Ross joins me now from his studio in London to discuss his latest book. But let's begin with a short reading from A Natural, where Tom is about to go onto the football pitch.
Into the light, the sudden exposure to the crowd, he focused on one specific area of the pitch and made his body move towards it. The goalkeeping coach was untying a bag of balls. They spilled like guts over the grass. Bobby fetched one of the balls and pointed for Tom and Yates to form a wide triangle with him. Bobby tapped the ball 4 or 5 times into the air without letting it drop, then lobbed it to Yates, who controlled it on his chest, before kicking it to Tom. The ball skewed off Tom's foot onto the grass. The next time it came round to him, he managed to control it, but his cushioned volley to Bobby landed short. Yates made a noise of displeasure, audible to Tom despite the crowd. The game, one that he had played almost every day since he was a small boy in the garden, was now a trial.
And that was Ross Raisin reading there from A Natural. Ross, in A Natural, we meet Tom, who's just been taken on by Town, who are a small division football team. And he's staying in a hotel before moving to Diggs. And you portray the life of a footballer somewhere, you know, between the life of a schoolboy and a minor royal almost. Can you give me a sense of this world that Tom and his teammates inhabit?
To somebody like me, who lives in an entirely different world, I just find the idea of it very peculiar and very, very sad, I think, especially when you put it in the context of the life of a young player. And I think that kind of in-betweenness that you describe there is very much part of the fabric of the footballer's life all the way through, from being very young to retirement. There's always an in-between, a liminal space to occupy between being a youth player and a fully-fledged senior, which is, i.e., being a boy to being a man. The space in between journeys, so coach journeys from the ground to the away ground, the space between being fit and being injured, the space between clubs, so being transferred from one club to another. There's a certain unrootedness, I think, that is always part of your day-to-day existence, or certainly the fear of being unrooted is always part of your day-to-day existence. And I think that the more I spoke to players, you know, of any age, the more that came across, that an insecurity about what will happen next.
I think it happens as well for so many of the young Irish kids who go over as well. They're not just away from home, they're in a whole separate country. And in Tom's situation, he's trying to succeed. There's a lot of things going on. He's trying to succeed at a new club, to fit in as a player and a person, deal with the isolation of being away. And Tosomi has it all, but this isolation deepens as he realises he's gay. So how does this add to his troubles?
Well, it doesn't make them easier for him, that's for sure. I think my interest, certainly as I began the novel, was in not so much the idea of what does a person do if they understand something about themselves, which might be I am gay, and find themselves in a world that is, view it how you want, either not accepting of that or just completely not understanding of that. I think my main interest and my main driver was actually, what do you do if you were a person who doesn't actually understand that about yourself? If perhaps you were in a different environment, one that is broader, more tolerant, more normal, then you might think that about yourself. You might think, well, I'm attracted to people of the same sex. But in that world, especially if you're a young player growing up in an academy system, the world is extremely heteronormative. And I don't think that a lot of people in Tom's position would recognise that about themselves, about their sexuality. And there's a huge discomfort and tension that I think arises from that. And a large part of the book is his discomfort at trying to understand who and what he is.
The book also, I mean, it deals with an awful lot of issues here. We're talking about sport, we're talking about class, identity, being gay. Which of those things came to you first in terms of the story, or was it much more organic than that?
It's always an organic thing, but I suppose, I think when you start to really invest in one particular angle that is interesting you imaginatively, then suddenly all the other ones come tumbling after it. And so the one I guess that was there at the beginning was identity. So the idea of growing up within a bubble, so growing up within the culture of a football club that has not much nuance to it. So you've been, and you continue to be coached into the idea that this is the person you have to aim for. And it's a quite simplistic idea of a person that basically boils down into somebody who is a winner, somebody who gives himself up as an individual for the sake of a team. In some ways, it's a very odd world, because it's one that we're not party to, because it's so closed off. And so these young lads find themselves at young ages, away from their families, away from their parents, possibly away from their home country, in an environment that's all geared towards being a superman. And that, I think, for a lot of people, is not a particularly healthy experience, and it creates lots of problems to do with sexuality, to do with relationships with women, to do with education, to do with a wider relationship with the world. Some of those boys go on to be a success and stay within that world until retirement in their 30s, when they're spewed out and they've got no way often of coping with the world that then presents itself in front of them. And the vast majority of them, probably 99% of them, who don't get as far as that. They probably reach 18, and at that point they are released into the world because they don't get the contract that they've dreamed of, and then they find themselves lost, I think.
A Natural originally started as a short story, and I'm wondering, what made you return to it and expand it into a novel? Was there a sense that you weren't finished with that story?
Yeah. I think that's about right. If I'm being perfectly honest, when I wrote the short story, I did have an eye towards something bigger, as in a novel. So when I wrote that short story, I didn't actually imagine at the time that it would become essentially the first chapter of the novel, which it has, largely, although with a movement of sex, certainly. But I did think there's one particular thing that I'm interested in to do with identity. I wonder what else might come from thinking about it hard. And so when I wrote the short story, it's got a quite particular and focused, quite intense angle to it that when I finished the short story, I realised had opened the door to something bigger for me, which was to do with sexuality, to do with different ways of viewing identity.
What kind of research did you do to write the novel? I'm curious, how did you go about contacting gay footballers, and how frank were they with you when you spoke to them? I imagine some people were afraid to even speak to you.
Oh, I wish it was that easy. I could have spoken to gay footballers. They're not easy to find and speak to. I still have not a great deal of awareness of who and how many gay footballers, or people who understand that about themselves, there are in professional football. Certainly there are no out gay footballers. Within professional British football, there's a guy that I spoke to who was wonderful, just very giving of his time and his knowledge, who is openly gay in non-league, plays for Gainsborough Trinity. It's a lad called Liam Davis. But his experience is very different, I think, to quite a lot of the footballers in the novel, in that he plays in non-league, and so he has a different relationship to the world outside of a football club. So he's got a job. He owns a cafe. And he said that when he came out, he had on the field some moments of people not accepting him, but largely it's been a very good and accepting experience, because his teammates, they know people outside of football because they work with them and they live with them, and so it's not as abnormal to them as perhaps a professional footballer would find it. So he's the only openly gay person within football that I did do some research with. So I spoke to, and I spoke to obviously a lot of footballers and people within the world of football, so coaches, directors, groundsmen. Oh, I had a wonderful time with the groundsmen, just finding out about pitches and all the science of the pitch. And through them, you know, obviously I would talk to them about homosexuality and how they felt about it and how they thought maybe their teammates would feel about it. And it's very difficult to know quite how guarded the answers are, because obviously the answers are usually, we'd be fine. Of course, we'd be perfectly accepting of it. And actually, my hunch is that for a lot of them, that probably would be the case. My understanding of it from the players that I do anecdotally have been told there are around who are gay within the football world, I think that their experience a lot of the time is that within certainly some of the squad that know about it, it's perfectly accepted and they feel comfortable. I think the discomfort is in the idea of what happens if they let that knowledge go beyond that circle. So perhaps to everybody within the football club, so the management team, the directors, and it makes a big difference, of course, the higher up you are within the ladder of football. So the higher up you are, the higher you are towards the Premier League, then the more media focus is going to be. And if a Premier League player came out, there would be an intense focus, spotlight on that person. And that's not going to be easy to deal with, even though it would inevitably be extremely overtly positive. I think the fear is what happens after that. What happens when you have a slump in form? Or what happens when you transfer to another club a year or two down the line? Does that manager deal with you the same way as the manager you've been with has dealt with you? There's a lot of unsureness, I think, and I think that unsureness is what has contributed to the fact that there are no openly gay professional footballers in Britain.
It's interesting that you say positive, because I think although the backroom staff and the other players and managers might be fine, but I think that the grief from the terraces would be very intense and off-putting.
Very possibly, but it's a balancing act, isn't it? How much does the grief and the hassle of that outweigh the grief and the hassle of living a secret life
for sure,
you know, decades? It's a very hard position. This is the interest in the book. How do you make that decision, and how do you keep control of it and make sure that it's entirely your decision? So the idea then that somebody else doesn't expose you for their own pleasure or their own gain. And I think aside from the spotlight of the media, the terraces is a big anxiety, and especially opposition fans, because you know, it's rare that you will go to a football match and not witness some form of homophobia. It's always banter, but it's homophobia, and it sits there. It sits there in the dark of a terrace, alongside racism, which happens often as well. Even though the picture that's often presented is one of the inside of a football stadium being very different to the 70s and 80s, which is true. And sometimes I think we're led to believe that none of that stuff goes on, but it does go on.
Hopefully one day it won't be a big issue at all, Ross, but thank you so much for speaking to us. A Natural by Ross Raisin is published by Jonathan Cape. Well, we've come to the end of this evening's show. Thanks so much to all of our guests, and we'll be back at the same time next Saturday, 6 p.m. The producer is Regan Hutchins, and the series producer is Zoe Cummins.